welcome to Section 9. My name's Damien Hull.
And I'm Dorothy. And today, Damien's going to talk about how to maintain and secure Section 9. I know we talked about doing something about this, and you kind of started making a plan about how we're going to do it. What can you tell us about it? Because you haven't shared that with me yet either.
So the first thing I want to look at is the most important systems for Section 9. Which systems or services do we have that have to be there? So in our case, the cloud servers are really important. We're talking about DNS and our website. If I don't have DNS, I don't get nobody can access our website, and I don't get any email. And then our website's there with the information we have on there about our show and the things we're doing. So that's really important to have as well.
So when you're talking about maintaining, what do you have in mind?
So again, first you look at the most important systems you have. And then the second thing I'm going to be looking at is the document from NIST, the one where they talk about doing a risk assessment and small business information security best practices. And that's the one we looked at a while back and we said, for us right now, this is no good. We're not ready for this.
It wasn't that it wasn't good. It was just it was so difficult to implement. I mean, we didn't even know where to begin. So, you know, how are you thinking of implementing it now? Was it different? What's different now that wasn't different then, I guess I should say?
Well, now I think we're a little bit more complex. We have things that we're trying to accomplish, like with our show, with our lab that's getting more complicated. And I think it's a good thing to have something in place that's sort of like a safety net. Like we are doing some things to make sure that the most important systems we have are going to stay up and running and they're not going to be down for any reason. Or if they do go down, we have a process to make sure we can bring them back to life.
So you're thinking from last week's show to the long ago show and then security is like, so for patch management, which systems really need it the most? And then how are you going to implement a process for that? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And one example that I like to use is the Center for Internet Security's top 20 security controls. It used to be called the SANS top 20. And when I saw that the first time, I thought, okay, well, you have to implement all 20. Otherwise, you're not secure.
I think most people would feel like that.
Yeah. And so when I went to my very first SANS event, the instructor talked about that and he said, forget the top 20. Only look at maybe the top 5. And even if you only implement, let's say, 3 of them, that's fine. You know, these may be things that you didn't have before. And when you implement them, you're going to be going in the right direction. You're going to have more security. You're going to be better off than you were before.
So how do you select your top 5? I mean, do you look at your network and you say, okay, this is what I need? Or do you just go with the first 5?
Well, you may look at the top 5 and you may say, okay, of these, which ones are really important? So we're not going to do that just yet. Eventually, we are going to get there. We are going to use some of them. For now, we're going to be taking a look at the NIST document, pulling some stuff from there, and then also using our patch management policy and beginning that process. So on the NIST side, again, they want you to do a risk assessment. And that's difficult to do. So the first thing they have you look at is the CIA triad, confidentiality, integrity, and availability. And you apply this to all your systems or the ones that you think are the most important. So in this case, we're going to apply these to our cloud servers. So we'll start with the web server. We'll use that as an example. Confidentiality means, do you have any confidential information on that particular system? This is a website or a web server with public information. We share this with the world. So no, we don't have any confidential information. So there's nothing we need in terms of making sure confidential information is kept secure, right? So we don't need something like encryption. We can weed that out.
Okay.
So I can just cross off confidentiality off our list. I don't have to worry about that. And then integrity. That's a bit tricky because we're talking about the integrity of information or data that sits on that particular system. Has it been modified by somebody that shouldn't be modifying the information? In our case, I'm just going to cross that off the list because we don't really need to worry about that. I'm really the only one who logs into that system and makes changes. Now, you might say, well, what happens if hackers get into the system and make modifications? And we'll talk about that in a minute. But then we have availability. It's really important for that server to be online because if it's not online, then nobody can access the information there. You know, so when we do our show, we talk about our show notes, We have our RSS feed that's on there that's part of how people access our podcast on things like iTunes or Stitcher. So that's also really important. We have to have that there. So the most important thing out of the CIA triad that we're looking at is availability.
Well, and your email as well, right?
So now we talk about our DNS servers.
Oh, okay.
So that's where email fits in. It's also part of the website as well. Because without DNS, nobody can go to section9.us. It won't work. Nobody can send me email at section9.us. And my email is really important. That's the one that I give out to everybody. So if somebody wants to email me, they're going to email me at section9.us. So DNS has to be there. Now let's take a look at our CIA triad. Confidentiality. Well, there's no real confidential information in there, so we can cross that off. Integrity. We need to make sure that the data within our DNS service is correct, that somebody's not going in there and modifying that, and then we have bad DNS information in there. But that isn't really too big of a deal because I'm the only one making those changes. So I can cross that off. It's not too important. So the only thing we have left is availability. And that's where, again, we need to make sure DNS is available, because if it's not, no website, no email. So that's kind of how we're using this document for now. In the future, we're going to go into more detail and try to do an actual risk assessment for those systems.
And are you going to be documenting everything you're doing, or what's your plan about that?
So we're going to document the process because it's going to be a tricky one, and we're going to have to learn how to do some of that. It's going to be difficult, and we're going to have to just do it together and see what happens and figure out.
I know you're very fond of, okay, let's do it first. Let's do it right now, because, you know, and I agree with you. Sometimes people spend so much time in planning, they never get started. And I know that's just not you. So I know you want to get it done and over with. And I think it's important that it gets documented every step of the way, because, you know, you think you're going to remember a step, but you might not.
Correct.
And I understand you're going to have to visit it over and over to just kind of twerk the instructions. But, you know, that was my thought.
So you're moving in the right direction. You're talking about the right things, because when I said, OK, let's do this, now we have to talk about policies and procedures. So we're talking about patch management policy last episode. That's where we're going to start. So we have the systems we want to keep secure and protected and always available, our cloud servers, DNS and website, right? Those are the important systems for Section 9. So one of the ways we're going to make sure these things are kept alive and healthy is with our patch management policy. So how do we do this? And why is patch management so important? Well, one of the things we've been talking about is malware getting in, hackers getting in. How do they do that? Most of the time, they're doing that because there is a vulnerability on that particular system, whether that's the operating system, a service has a vulnerability, a third-party application might have a vulnerability. There's some kind of vulnerability on there. The way we fix that is by patching the system, patching those third-party applications. So in our case, we're going to be patching the web server, and we're going to be patching our DNS servers and making sure that those are safe. We haven't created a formal policy just yet. So a quick one for me is going to say, to be saying, I'm the one who's going to maintain those systems, right? So that's my responsibility, because you were talking about that before. My job in all of that is to patch those cloud servers once a month.
Right.
And now you know, because I'm telling you, that once a month, I'm going to be patching these systems.
Well, you have to have the rules and the roles. What are we going to do, and who's going to do it? Do you see? What are we going to do? How often are we going to do it? Whose responsibility is that in order for you to do the risk assessment, correct?
Well, that's not really part of the risk assessment. It's part of maintaining.
It's part of patch management anyway.
It's part of the patch management process. It's part of maintaining things.
Mm-hmm.
Who is going to do what and when? And that's huge. When you start getting complex like we are, you have to know who's going to do what and when they're going to do it. So in my case, let's be more clear about what's going to happen and when it's going to happen and how I'm going to do that. So we're talking about our cloud servers. I'm going to patch them the last week of every month. So now you know when, you know who, and I'm going to follow a defined procedure that works for me.
One of the things that we were talking about in back episodes was, okay, whenever somebody needs to make a change in a lab, you got to check with somebody else. That's also part of the patch management. And I think they call it the global security people that usually before you make a change, you have to check with them, basically saying, okay, I'm about to make a change. I'm going to change the IP addresses on this particular switch because I need to do a lab to do this, that, and the other. And I want to make sure that it doesn't interfere with some other part of the lab.
Yeah, what you're talking about is more change management policy. But we do have that for patch management in where, you know, I define how my process is going to work. At some point, I may say I need to make a change to the way I do my patches for this particular system. That's when we have to sit down together and say, okay, here's what I want to do. Here's why I want to do it. Do we both agree?
Right. And then, you know, I know I'm getting ahead because I know you want to take this and break it into bite-sized pieces because it is a huge project to implement that NIST document, as well as some of the security measures that you probably have in mind, you know.
Right. So here's how the process is going to work. And this is just kind of an overview. So I go into our DigitalOcean site, and that's where we have all of our cloud servers hosted. And then I'm going to make a snapshot, which is like, these are virtual machines, so you can snapshot the whole entire system. And that's just like how we do a snapshot in VMware, in VirtualBox, same exact thing. So once I have a snapshot, that's my backup plan. That helps save me in the case where I do an update or I patch the system and, oh my God, it doesn't work now.
Something goes terribly wrong.
Right. Yeah. And I've seen that happen on the website where I do something, now the website's broken, I got to go back to that previous snapshot.
So part of the risk assessment, and I'm trying to understand risk assessment, so please bear with me. So part of the risk assessment would be, okay, I'm going to do patch management on one of our cloud servers. This server is very important. So the one thing that I have to do is take a snapshot, because if something happens, you know, or maybe if something goes terribly wrong, I have to have this snapshot in place to be able to repair it. Or is that not part of it? You know, I guess I don't understand risk management probably like you do.
So that's a good question. And you're kind of sort of in the right kind of general area. So there's a couple of things. I look at risk in kind of a different way. And I see myself as risk, right? Mm-hmm. Because I may make a configuration mistake someplace and now my system doesn't work. So as a way to minimize or mitigate the chance that I'm going to damage the system and we won't be able to recover, my backup is there.
Okay.
So you could kind of say that's part of your risk assessment plan. But risk assessment in the case of this NIST document and in the case of security is more along the lines of malware and threats.
Okay,
and
so it's what something terribly wrong that could happen that you have no control over. How do you deal with that?
Exactly. Okay. So, but it could be something as simple as saying IT deleted something that shouldn't have been deleted.
Right.
An end user deleted something that shouldn't have been deleted. Your assessment of the backup or the snapshot is part of that, but we don't generally talk about that.
Right, but the risk assessment would be, okay, how many outside risk can affect this very important thing and how many inside risk could affect that? Like you were saying, you know, I consider myself a risk as a user because I can really screw it up. And, you know, and then you have hackers that may try to bring in some malware. So what you're looking globally is like, and this particular thing is very important. What are the vulnerabilities? And do I have a plan to deal with those should the worst case scenario happen?
Exactly. And one of the things that I think you're kind of moving in that direction, which I think a lot of organizations and a lot of people in IT don't think about, when we talk about things like least privilege, right? Giving people access to the things they need access to and then denying them access to everything else. One of the reasons why you want to do that is to prevent mistakes, right? If I give somebody access to something they shouldn't have, there is a risk involved in that. They could go in there and delete the file. So that's an internal risk that you have to take into consideration. Now, again, when we talk about this NIST document, I think they're focusing more on the external factor, the malware factor, the hacker factor, and there's other things in there that they're probably covered. But we'll figure that out once we start looking at that and applying that to Section 9 overall as a whole. So we'll have a better understanding of that in the future, which we can talk about then. But for now, We're just doing something basic.
Right.
So I have my snapshot. That's the first thing I want to do before I update any of our cloud servers. And then what I'm going to do once it's finished is go through the update process, right? So these are, Linux systems. We're going to do our update with that. We're going to do dist-upgrade versus just an update or upgrade. Because we want to take out all the old stuff and make sure the new stuff gets in there, like the new kernel, new applications get installed if they need to be, so that all of it is updated. And then I want to go and reboot the system, because if I get a new kernel, it won't be applied until I reboot the system. And then I want to test the services on there. Does the website work? Does DNS work? So there has to be a process for that. And then as we go through this, we're going to see things that we like. We're going to see things that we don't like. And the steps that we take to do all of this may not be enough for you because you've never done this before. So when you look at the steps I have documented, you may say, gee, that's nice, but I can't follow that. I don't know enough. I don't know where to go. I don't know what to click on. I don't know if the snapshot is done. How do I, you need to give me more information. And that's fine. That's how this process works. You work with your team and you make sure everybody on the team understands how this works. And if there's people on the team that don't understand it, you got to change the process.
Well, and I think when it comes to documentation, like for me, my goal is going to be to be as specific as possible or do it as they would call the ID10T method, because you never know who's going to come along on that particular position. Look at those instructions. You don't know how much they know. You don't know how much experience they have. For you, that you would be only writing some of the steps because you already know some of the stuff and you don't feel the need to write it down. That would work just fine for you. But when it comes to me, if I don't have those extra steps in there, because I know that we've been working in a project and I would say, I don't know how to do this. And you're like, okay, you're not going to know this because, you don't have the experience and you haven't done this, that, and the other. But if you had, then, you wouldn't have to write that down. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, and there is a danger in that. Yes, you're right. That's what I did when I wrote this documentation. So the procedures I have are based on the fact that I've done this several years and I know what the process is. I kind of have an idea of what I'm supposed to do. The problem I have with documentation like that is that sometimes in an emergency, you forget. You're like, right. Oh, you're in panic mode now. And you forget simple, basic things. And so I think that even though I know what's going on, I've done this several times, I don't need a complete process here. In an emergency, I want more than I need because I'm going to forget things when that happens.
Well, and if you don't do it all the time, you will forget it. I mean, that's the biggest thing for me, still not being in IT and trying to do some of the things that I have to do. When life gets in the way, an emergency comes along and I'm not able to get back to one of those things that I'm doing, when I come back to it, if I don't have that written down on my instructions, who's to say I'm going to remember how to do that? And in my mind, when I'm going along, it's like, well, I'll remember that. Oh, yeah, I'll remember that. But at the end of the day, you're right. I may not remember that. And that could be the difference between, my project working or not. So I think that's very important. And I'm glad that you're thinking about it that way.
Yeah, so that's what we're going to be doing for our cloud systems. And again, later on, we will talk about the local network and what we have on there and what's really important, things like internet service, right? We have to make sure that's functioning. But we'll get there in time. I want to talk about some things that we ran into here, some interesting things that we've been working on, some fun stuff that we have planned for the future. We were working with a Cisco switch because I signed us up.
Oh, yeah. So a friend of yours, a friend of Damien's brought him a switch and say, hey, I think he does volunteer work, right?
He needed somebody to help him out because he was busy. He didn't have time to take a look at the switch. He's setting up a network for some kind of church or something like that. And it's just volunteer stuff. So I thought, okay, well, I'll help him out. I'll get a switch. And my thinking was this. This is going to be good for you because you can set up the switch and you're going to be able to count that as...
Well, tell everybody what he wanted us to do with the switch.
He wanted us to do something really basic. Just give it an IP address for management purposes. Give it a default gateway. Put in a password and call it done.
Right.
Right?
And what was the first thing I came across?
Well, you were complaining because you were saying, hey, this is, I don't understand, this is not working. And I had never even touched this thing. I hadn't looked at it. I hadn't checked it. And yes. So I thought, what? Why is she complaining? She's done Cisco switches before. What's the big deal?
Show IP interface brief. You know, I was doing all my commands and a lot of them weren't working the way that they usually did. And I couldn't figure out why. I couldn't see IP addresses that were already there. I mean, I think the only thing that I could really use the regular commands that I used to was that the start configuration, you know, and I was able to see it. And so I could see what was configuring there. Another thing was the password. I didn't know what the password was. So I put Cisco in it and nothing happens. So I press enter and it let me in to be able to do some of the configurations. But yeah, there was a lot of weird things. So basically what I ended up doing, Damien told me, is come up with the IP addresses that you need to have, you know, like a network address, broadcast address. What else was it? The range, you know, of addresses, one for the default gateway and what have you, because we had to test it before giving the switch. And so I looked up what type of switch it was. It was a catalyst. I don't have it with me, you know, what the number was, but it was an old catalyst one. And then, and you know, I Googled it and I started looking at some of the commands and I noticed right away the commands were so much different than they were for the Cisco. They seem to be a little more awkward is the best way I can describe them. I want to call them complicated, but they seem awkward. But I was able to find the correct way to add an IP address in this particular switch. So I printed out the commands and then you want to take it from there?
Yeah, so she didn't have time to finish this project.
Mm-hmm.
So I took over and I log into the thing and I'm like, whoa, what's going mm-hmm. on here? This is not what I'm used to. And after about a half hour or maybe even an hour, because I was using the instructions you had printed out. And so I was just going through the process of you know, setting up the switch with the IP addresses that we were given and just going through the motions. After about a half hour or so, I said, wait a minute, maybe this is this CatOS thing that I had heard about. So there's Cisco iOS, which is what I'm used to, which is what you're used to. And that's where you can go in there and you can do config T and get your configs in there.
Yeah, I couldn't do that. It wouldn't take config T. That was one of the first things. It was like crazy.
So on this particular switch running Catalyst OS or CatOS for short, it's all set commands. So you go into user mode, then you go into enable mode.
Yeah.
And right there is where you type in your set commands. Setting up the IP address was relatively easy. Getting into some of the other configurations was a little bit tricky. And then it was just, we managed to get it to work, but it was not what I was expecting because I'm an iOS user. I don't know anything about this Catalyst OS. And we'll have to do some research on that to find out if Catalyst OS is coming back, because it is an older thing, because they started out with the CatOS, then they went to iOS, and I don't know if CatOS is making a comeback for certain Cisco devices, but we'll have to do some homework on that, because it's something, like if they're bringing that back,
well,
we need to know.
Like I can tell you, that when I kept trying to do config T to be able to add the IP address, and I kept complaining to you, I can't get into config T, you won't let me do this, and you kept saying, just look it up. Do your homework. What's going on, you know? So, it wasn't very friendly, I have to say.
No, and you know, that's the thing. It's like I
hope they don't bring it back.
Well, so now we have a config. I saved the config. In fact, I sent it to the guy. So,
oh, good.
And I told the guy, I said, oh, yeah, we had some issues working with this thing because I told him, I said, you know, I gave it to my girlfriend and she was trying to work with it and I kind of feel bad because I told her, just look up the stuff. It should work. So you have experience. Why are you telling me that this thing's not working? I don't understand.
I felt bad. You know why I felt bad? Because it's been a while since I played with the switches. And then, you know, I'm always able to configure, if nothing, the switch or a router. That is something I know I have solid. And I have configurations. And I went to my notes. And the thing that frustrated me was like, oh my God, have I been gone too long to where I can't do this anymore? So it was really frustrating. But did the guy, does he know how to configure switches? Or... Did he not have time or how?
I think he just didn't have time to configure this.
But he knew there was a CatOS then?
So I was telling him, hey, you know, I told my girlfriend she should just configure the thing and it's not going to be too big of a deal. It's really simple. Mm-hmm. Just give it an IP address and you should be done. And then it was like, okay, I'm having issues. And then when I went and looked at it, I said, something's wrong here. And I told him, I said, we had to do all this homework because I just realized, you know, half hour into it that this is CatOS. And he's like, oh yeah, it's CatOS.
It'd be nice if you could have told us.
Well, I didn't even think to ask.
He probably didn't even think about it.
You know, so we were able to get it going. And I told him, I said, if you have anything else, now we can configure them.
So you actually documented, you gave him the documentation. Did you keep it for us as well? Or
so you can save the config just like we do with any other Cisco device.
Okay.
You know, you go in there and copy and paste the stuff. And so we have that. It's on your desktop. So, you know, if we get another one, you change the stuff in there and you just paste it in and you should be fine.
Yeah.
So we have that figured out. So that's the one thing that we're working with. And that was kind of an interesting process. So we learned something from that. And then we're also going to be setting up a new desk for you and a new monitor and a new computer. And
I get to build my own computer. And oh my goodness, Damien ordered this humongous monitor. It's like so pretty. It's just really long and just really good. Oh my
God. Yeah. So I ordered a Dell ultra wide monitor. So I can't remember what the number is, but it's like one of those 38 inch monitors, the ultra wide ones now that are coming out.
Oh my gosh.
And you know, you look at it on the picture and it's like, okay.
It doesn't do it justice. Let me tell you, you have to see this thing live. It is gorgeous.
But it's huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's going to take up most of the desk. I mean, it's going to be, you know, but it's going to be super cool. And then we have a mini ITX case with a mini ITX motherboard, and it's going to have 32 gigs of RAM. It's going to be water cooled.
And he's expecting me to build this, which I'm looking forward to it, actually, because I help out putting new memory on the little mini server that we have, the gigabyte server. And I put in an SSD in it too. But this is going to be my first computer built from scratch. So
one thing that I did show you this. We have that website, PC Parts Picker.
Yeah.
So that was really cool for me. I didn't know that existed. But you can go there and you can just start picking parts. And it will tell you if they go together. And then you can also see what other people have built. It's free. You don't have to pay for any of that service. And again, you can go and see what other people have done in terms of building their own systems. And it tells you what goes together. The hard part for me in picking out the right motherboard and the right parts is that we're going to have Windows on here and Linux on here. So they have stuff in there for Windows because Windows pretty much runs on all of this stuff because they have drivers for Windows that will work with pretty much anything. You don't necessarily have that with Linux. So I had to do some extra research online to make sure the motherboard was going to function properly. And once I did that, then I could pick out what we needed. And then there's also, you know, different options for graphics card and, how you're going to cool the system. Do you want a fan? Do you want liquid cooled? Do you want custom liquid cooled? And custom liquid cooled is kind of cool because you get to put in your own tubing for the liquid cooling. You can have fluorescent ones in there.
Oh, nice.
But they were so, I mean, by the time you get done with liquid cooling, if you do the
So what
custom,
did we get?
So we have one that's not custom because custom, I mean, some of the custom liquid cooling, I mean, they were like $400, $500, $600, $700, $800 to do your custom liquid cooling. And I think the one that I picked out was, you know, in less than $200.
No, that's not bad though. I mean, to me, it doesn't have to be super fancy. I'm just so excited that I'll get to put this together from scratch and just learn in the process. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah, and then we also have a pretty fancy graphics card, one that I've never had before. And, you know, I've never had anything this fancy before. So
why'd you choose a fancy one?
Well, because I want us to be able to do all kinds of cool stuff. Plus, I want to make sure that we can power that giant monitor.
Okay.
I don't want something wimpy and then we plug it in and it's like, nope, not going to work. So, you know, we can play games on this thing. You know, we can try to some of the new games that are out there.
Because we have all this time to play games, really?
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of the things that I want us to sort of kind of get into.
Yeah.
You know, just
no,
so we can see, you know.
When we get our lives back.
Yeah, so that's kind of going to be an interesting project. It's going to be a lot of fun to put that together.
No, I'm really looking forward to it, I have to tell you.
Yeah. So anything else?
No. You?
So, no, I think that's it. I think we got a lot going on. I'm going to be focusing on making sure our servers are up to date once a month. At the end of every month, I'll do that and make sure that you understand what's going on. And then you're extremely busy. So you have lots going on. And eventually what you're going to do is focus on...
We're still going to be reporting on the projects that we have. I mean, we have a lot of them going on. And we have also life getting in the way at this time, which is kind of a... You know, we have a major personal crisis with a family member. But, you know, we'll work through that. I mean, and you know, this is also important when you're in IT. This is going to happen. You may have a big personal crisis that you have to say, oh, my goodness, I have to stop working on this and, you know, and then get back to it. But, you know, we're just kind of moving forward the best way that we can, a little bit of a time. But we still will report on the projects that we're working on and just keep you updated on the new things we're doing. And, you know, so that'll be it.
Yeah, we'll get there. So if you have any comments or questions, you can email us at section9.us. And if you want to take a look at our show notes, you can go to section9.us and see those.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening.